Hi everybody, I'm Justin Chisholm, welcoming you to another episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast, which this time comes to you from San Francisco, California, where 8 international professional sailing teams are out on the bay practicing for the million-dollar grand final of the second season of SailGP. My guest this time is the prolific Australian skipper Tom Slingsby, who, as well as leading the SailGP rankings at this stage with his Australian SailGP team, has also in recent months won the Moth World Championship and line honours in the Middle Sea Race aboard the Maxi Comanche, hit with the top teams at his first ever TP52 Worlds. Slingsby has been a mainstay of the SailGP movement from its inception and is very enthusiastic about its future. However, he is also a past America's Cup winner and, as you'll hear in the interview, he has not yet ruled out getting involved with the 37th America's Cup. Tom Slingsby, we're sitting here in the Australia SailGP base at the end of what seems to me to have been a pretty hectic few months of sailing for you. A lot of great performances, including a win at the Moth World. Has it been a bit of a whirlwind for you?
Yeah, last year for sure was it was very busy. With the whole COVID situation, I guess I was forced into more sailing than I would usually do, in that I wasn't able to come home to Australia, so I ended up spending 7 months in Europe. And with that, I didn't want to sit around and sort of relax, so I thought I'd just do as much sailing as I could, and that ended in me doing a lot of sailing and getting a lot of good results. So it turned out to be a great year for me.
A lot of the stuff I've read about you, you like to do lots of different types of sailing. That's kind of one of your ethoses. Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, it all started in 2008. I finished the Olympics there with a poor result, and Nathan Outridge and I have always been really good friends, and we said to each other, we should just try to sail all different types of boats, and do as much as we can in fast boats, slow boats, and just say yes to everything and try and improve our sailing. And so we bought A-classes, we got second-hand Moths, and we just started sailing around on anything we could get our hands on. And for me especially, I think it was a huge sort of eye-opener coming from the laser class to these fast boats, learning about apparent winds and trapezing and foiling and all these things. It just sort of, I just loved the challenge. I started enjoying my sailing more, and my results, even in the laser, improved. So I thought this is definitely the future for me.
I remember in 2012, I was in Weymouth when you crossed the line to win the gold. I remember it was very emotional for you. It was obviously a kind of private moment being played out publicly. Can you remember that moment?
Yeah, I remember it really well. There was so much that had gone into winning that gold medal in London, and so much highs and lows of the sports, sort of winning world titles to choking at Olympics to injuries where I was out for a long time to coming back from the injury and not getting good results, and there's just so many highs and lows over the sort of 10 years that I'd been campaigning hard, 12 years I'd been campaigning hard, and to finally sort of achieve my goals and reach, sort of hit my dreams and stuff like that. It was just emotional. It sounds bad. I sort of obviously won the gold medal for Australia, but it was just, for me, it was just such a satisfying moment personally. And I just felt like all the pressure was off. It wasn't really an elation. It was more relief more than anything.
How long had you had that Olympic dream? How long had you been dreaming of that medal?
I can tell you almost exactly to the day. It was the day Ben Ainslie won his gold medal in Sydney. I was down there cheering on Michael Blackburn as a 15-year-old on the rocks in Sydney Harbour. I was cheering on the Aussie, and he ended up coming away with a bronze. And on the train ride home that day, I had a two-hour train ride home each day, and I said right then and there that I was going to win a gold medal for Australia. So September 2000 was when I set the goal, and August 2012 was when I reached it.
Wow. And I understand that you had an alternative sport which you could have gone down. Tennis was... You were pretty good at the tennis.
I was pretty good at tennis. I don't know if I would have been successful, but I think that's why I didn't... I hadn't really noticed the Olympics much. I was more in the professional sports, sort of watching the tennis, the golf, and things like that. But then the Olympics came to Australia, and I was just fascinated by it, and I ended up giving up tennis. I don't know if I could have been as a top player at all. I might have made a living out of it, but yeah, reaching the top is pretty tough there. But it was just the Olympics. I quit tennis and started dedicating myself to being an Olympian.
What did you start sailing in? What was your first sailing moment? I always like to ask because it's always different.
Yeah, I started sailing in a Sabo in Australia, which is similar to an Optimist. And yeah, I think my first day sailing was, I was about 5 years old. And then I remember my first race, I think I was about seven. But as a junior sailor, I didn't take it seriously. I was just doing it with friends once a week. And it was only after the Olympics in Sydney that I started taking it serious and started training and dedicating myself to the sport.
A lot of people that I interview as professional sailors, at some point they work for a sailmaker. Did you ever do that?
I did work experience at North Sails in Sydney. It was a 2 week work experience, and unfortunately I didn't make the 2 weeks. I did a week and a half and decided I didn't want to do that, and I got to get better at this sailing thing to try to be an athlete, I guess.
And was the goal always to make a living from sailing, you know, aside from the gold medal itself?
No, it wasn't really. Back when I decided I wanted to be go to the Olympics for sailing, there you really couldn't make a career out of it back then. This was sort of before the glory years of the America's Cup for professional sailors, and definitely at the Olympic level, they were not earning enough to survive. I just said, okay, I'll find a job to pay for my sailing. But right when I started, I remember the years between sort of 2002 when I left school to 2005 was really tough. I was working a couple of jobs, working in a bar. I was a boat builder for a while. I was a fisherman for a while there as well.
Wow.
Just trying to give myself time to go training. And it was really tough. But then in about 2005, 2006, the Australian sailing team was able to get a lot more sponsorship. And then all of a sudden, by about 2006, 2007, I was able to quit my bar job and dedicate myself purely to sailing and go full time. And obviously, that made a difference. Sort of being able to wake up. It's all about your health, fitness, improving your level and time on the water, and then your home stretching instead of running off to your other job. So it definitely improved my sailing.
Who did you work with coaching wise then?
For my first Olympics, I was with Arthur Brett for 2008, and then in 2009 I started working with Michael Blackburn,
who of course had won.
Yeah,
he won the gold, I think.
Yeah, it was a really interesting journey with Michael. I guess he was a hero of mine. He won a bronze in Sydney. He was my hero, so I looked up to him. And then for the 2004 and 2008 trials, he became my rival. 2004, he beat me in the Olympic trials. 2008, we were head-to-head, first and second in the world. It was a flip of a coin who would win each event out of us, but we had jumped above everyone else. And I ended up getting the nod from him. So we were rivals. He was my sort of idol, and then he was my rival, and then he became my coach in 2009, And now he's just a good friend, a bit of a mentor to me, and yeah, we still keep in touch all the time.
So that gold medal, how did your life change at that point? Had you thought beyond the gold medal?
I really hadn't. Literally, people always say that, oh, do you think about what's going to happen if you win? And I never did. I probably did in 2008 when I went in as a favourite and thought I'm going to walk away with this, and I got absolutely smoked, and I think from then on I just never let myself think that way. I knew that it doesn't matter what you do, you can win every World Championship, every World Cup event, and the Olympics is a different beast. And I wasn't going to let myself think that way again. So it really wasn't until I crossed the line in that final medal race where I truly believed it over. And even if you watch that medal race, I was sailing. I had a 14-point lead into it, but I was sailing like we're on even points, and whoever won this race got it. Because I just didn't want to leave anything to chance. So it was a bit of a shock to the system after you win, and you get a lot of attention.
I'm sure. Is that something you deal easily with?
No, I don't. I think I'm naturally a bit of an introvert. I don't particularly like getting up in front of crowds, people looking at me, doing public speaking or anything like that. I'm not terrified by it, but it's not something I choose to do, that's for sure. And because my gold medal was the first individual gold medal that Australia, we had to that point a particularly poor Olympics, and when the medals weren't coming, the gold medals definitely weren't coming, so it was a bit of a shock to see how much attention that medal got for sailing in general, got for myself and just for the sport. It was huge. Getting asked to go on breakfast TV shows all around the country and paraded around, and it was a fun ride, but it's not something I'd probably do again.
But did the phone start ringing at this point?
The phone was ringing off the hook for sure. But if I'm honest, it was mainly media interviews. I don't think there were that many huge opportunities that arose out of it. It was tough for me. I had signed with Oracle Team USA in, I think it was September, October the year before in 2011, and the agreement I made was once I finish the Olympics, I'll join Oracle full-time. And so I had a week off after the Olympics in Australia, and then I flew to San Francisco, and I didn't leave pretty much for the whole time for the remainder of the Cup. So I didn't really see all the sort of perks that come with winning a gold medal in Australia, because I left the country pretty shortly after and was full-time into a new campaign.
That must have been a bit of a culture shock, going from yourself and your coach and maybe a few other people involved, but control of your own campaign into 100 people, 110 people in San Francisco.
Yeah, it really was. It was just myself and my coach really just travelling the world, myself and Blackers travelling the world, doing it all together, and then all of a sudden I'd always been with Blackers. I'd sort of lost him, and I'd moved to the America's Cup, and I was part of a team of 165 people.
Wow.
And in the sailing team alone, I think we had 26. And I went from, I guess in the laser class, being a sort of a big fish in a small pond to being a very small fish in a big pond at Oracle. And I arrived here after just winning a gold medal, doing all the athlete parades around Australia and everyone knowing who I was, I wasn't even allowed on the boat at Oracle. I had to do my time. I was cleaning winches. I was rigging AC-45s. When the AC-72 would go sailing, I wasn't allowed on it because I hadn't proven myself. And it was a bit of a hazing period, I guess. And it was a shock to the system.
How well did you know Jimmy at that point?
I knew Jimmy. We'd been friends, but not too close, for about maybe 5 or 6 years before that. Just sort of, hi, how are you going? And how's your sailing going? Different things like that. But then, obviously, joining the same team as him and living together in San Francisco, we got to know each other pretty well.
You developed a really good rapport on the boat between the two of you, and obviously we've seen the success that came from that. Did that come slowly? Did you have to kind of start to trust each other?
Yeah, for sure. As I said, I wasn't really allowed on the boat. There were all the legends on board. It was Murray Jones, John Kostecki, Simon Daubney, Matt Mason. They were sort of running the show, and I was just this young, inexperienced laser sailor. But I did, out of everyone, at this time we didn't really know we were going to be foiling, and when the boat started foiling a bit more, that's when I knew I had something to give, because I'd been, by this stage, sailing Moths for 2-3 years, and I sort of had immersed myself in that quite a lot. But I remember going to Jimmy and saying, how do I get on the boat? I want to sail. And he said, well, you either really got to be a grinder or a really technical position here. And we've got JK, who's a tactician, and me steering, and then Dirk Derrida Cheese, who's a wing trimmer, and then the rest are pretty much grinders. So get your grinding scores up and then you might get an opportunity. And so I remember when he told me that, it was probably December 2012, and I did 3-4 months whenever the boat would go sailing and I was left on shore. I would go and do an hour or two of grinding on the machines, and by March we had a fitness test, and I'd been eyeing it off for a long time, and I said, I'm gonna smoke anyone around me who's in my weight class. And I was able to do that. I got a really good grinding score, and then they knew I had some foiling experience and the boats were starting to foil more and more. And so I got the opportunity to be a grinder in the back pedestal, and sort of developed a bit of a role of a strategist, which we hadn't had before, working with JK and essentially being a grinder though at the start.
Famously, there was a kind of transition for that Oracle team. Ben Ainslie came in. People talk a lot about Ben's influence on that, but I also saw a big change in you. I felt like you had more control, you had more input into how the boat was sailed, and am I right? Is that what it felt like for you?
Yeah, it. There's a lot of reasons, I guess, a lot of things, factors at play, but I was a young guy in the team, and I felt like I had to sort of know my place. Two eyes, two ears, and one mouth. I had plenty of opinions, but I'd spoken to some of the older guys in the team, and they said, look, just like you can't come in here and just tell everyone how it's done. You got to slowly build up respect, and people will start asking your opinion. And so that's what I was really trying to do, is sort of keep my thoughts to myself a little bit, and if people want to know my opinion, then I can tell them. But when Ben joined, Ben said to me, he says, I've never done tactics before. He goes, I've always steered, like I've never been a tactician on a boat. And he said, look, I want you to just say what you think. I want you to just keep talking to me, and let's just have an open communication between myself, Ben, and Jimmy, and let's just have this, everyone giving our 2 cents, and there's no wrong opinion. Let's just work that way. And it was just a different dynamic. Ben was in a great position in the end. We were down 4-1 when he joined, but we were 4-1, sorry. And we knew that we were going to lose the America's Cup at that stage. And so Ben and everyone on the boat really were like, let's start trying things. We've got to try something, otherwise we're going to lose. And so that real open-mindedness sort of approach let us sort of, I guess I'm a bit of a free thinker in foiling world, and I've got some crazy ideas, and it allowed me to really, I was very hard on the foiling upwind for months prior to that cup. I was saying we need to do this more and more, but we weren't, with the designers and some of the sailors, there was a bit of resistance, I guess, because it was so out of the box and you would have to do more tacks up the upwind and things like that. And but Ben said, look, if you think it's faster, let's do it. And so I was allowed to sort of bring that approach in, and Ben was fully supportive, and Jimmy was fully supportive, and we're able to start improving the boat rapidly, and we copied the Kiwis a lot. Everyone who sort of looks down at you saying, oh, you just copied, I go, I copy everyone in my sailing approach. If it's tactics, if it's the way people sail the boat, I used to look at Ben Ainslie and just copy the way he sailed a laser, or Robert Schott. And then you try to get to their level, and then you try to evolve your own thing, and copying is in every sport. If Federer's got the best forehand in the game, people look at it and go, how do I duplicate that? And every sport you got to copy, and I think it's a good thing.
Nathan Outridge told me that I asked him how he learned to sail a moth, and he said, by watching YouTube videos.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how you improve, is you got to copy people, and anyone who sort of shuns you for that just doesn't get it. And yeah, so we copied the Kiwis, and we just had this great dynamic on board that was able to sort of progress and evolve really quick, and then everyone saw what happened.
Compare that victory to the Olympic victory. It's a bit of an unfair question, but which one would you trade off?
Obviously both are unbelievable, especially the way we did the America's Cup was in the dramatic fashion, and for me, first time ever really being with a team, it was unbelievable. But yeah, nothing will beat my Olympic journey, just the highs and lows and how hard I worked for it, and waking up at 5 a.m. and going cycling in the pouring rain, and training when no one else would train, because when it was 35 knots and huge waves, I knew that no one else would be training, and so I would make myself go out there because I had to be doing things that no one else could do. It was such a mental struggle, those 12 years, and to get the right result at the end of it was... And also, like, I've got such a hard head. Once I set a goal, if I didn't win a gold medal there, and I'd still be going for a gold medal in the laser. I wouldn't have changed. I wouldn't have gone to the America's Cup. Probably I'd be still trying to, because once I set a goal, I have to achieve it. And so it was quite a relief to get it done reasonably early in my career.
So you stepped away from the America's Cup and we're here with CellGP. Famously, the CellGP thing is going from strength to strength. But are you done with the America's Cup?
Good question. I don't think it's any surprise to anyone, but I have been talking to the US team, American Magic. Remains to be seen if we can come to an agreement. But look, I love what CellGP is doing, and I think CellGP is the future. I think in 10 years, people will be looking at CellGP and remembering these days of when it started and when it was in its infancy. So I think my future is always going to be CellGP, but I'd love to be part of that big team dynamic again and sail those boats. The AC75 looks so much fun, and I think I've still got plenty I could offer in terms of design development and sailing skills to a team, but at this stage, no, I haven't signed with anyone.
Okay. It will be a tantalising prospect, the thought of you on one wheel and Paul Goodison on the other.
Yeah, we've been rivals for a long time, but I think after the Olympics in 2012, we buried the hatchet, and we've been good friends since. And I'd love to have that opportunity working alongside him. We chat at Moth Worlds, and we talk about the design and developments and ideas we could do. And I think we would work really well together and run off each other well. And we've got such a history together. We really know how talented each one of us is, and so there's so much respect there. I think it could be a really cool dynamic.
Okay, well, fingers crossed that we see that from my point of view.
We'll see.
Let's talk about CellGP a little bit. I get the feeling CellGP is kind of coming of age right now. It's evolved, it's had its setbacks with COVID and the whole thing, you know, getting delayed, which doesn't make it easy. But have you seen the circuit evolve in a big way?
100%. Behind the scenes, it's booming. We've got a lot of interest in new teams. We've got plenty of new sponsorship and venues coming forward saying we want to host our GP events. And then we've got the best sailors. I think for sailors watching around the world, it's been such an interesting proposition, because previously you've had Peter Burling and racing... Ben Ainslie, but they're in totally different boats, and you wonder who's actually better out of these two. But when you get them in the same boat, obviously one person's not going to beat the other all the time, and it's a real battle of consistency to really measure how sailors stack up against each other. But we're really seeing sort of different trends, and someone might be better in lighter winds, someone might be better in heavier winds, and things that you could never have known if the guys didn't jump in the same type of boat and compete on level playing field. And it's interesting, and for me, I guess being here from the start and more talent coming, and to the point where you really can't name many people who are missing from the lineup, it's been great for me just to sort of, I'm always trying to test myself, and when Ben Ainslie joined, I was like, oh, this is going to be a huge test. And then all of a sudden, Peter Burling joined, Jimmy Spithill joined, and to join me and Nathan Outridge, and it was, it's been amazing. And then to see the young talent coming through, and Phil Robertson, he's been a shock to us all how unbelievably talented he is. And see the new guys coming through, like Quinton from France. He's been out there doing great things in training. I think he's got a big future, and Nikolai's really improving also from the Danish.
Tell us about the experience of sailing these F50s. We've seen them previously race around in match racing. Now we're seeing them in fleet racing, and the fleets are getting bigger each time. I thought six boats was a lot. Eight boats seems really a lot to me. And you're going to move on to 10. It must be sensory overload for you guys out there.
Yeah, it really is. I remember when we came up with this concept, we said, how are we going to put these boats on a start line? It's too dangerous. But I guess it's just something when, with experience, you get used to. So slowly but surely, we got used to. I remember when we started Sail GP, we were too scared to put more than three boats on a start line together. And then we upped it a couple of days later to four, and then five, and then six for the first race of the season one. And now we've got eight, and a lot more talent, and a lot more luffing, and dipping and ducking, and it's crazy in the pre-start. And we're moving to 10, and I can tell you now we're not stopping at 10. It's who knows where it's going to stop. Larry and Russell have a vision for this, and it's evolving all the time, and it's getting bigger and better all the time.
I know Russell is very proud of it. Larry, we hear less from your point of view. Is he really happy with the way this is going and the pace that it's developing at?
I obviously don't talk to him much anymore, but we get updates from Russell, who's in regular communication, and he's very much involved. He's watching every event. He's watching the docos behind the scenes. He's all over what developments to the boat, whether it's the foil design and whether it's changing the wings. He's all over every development. And he'll be here in San Francisco watching it again firsthand. And from what I hear, he loves it. And but he's always changing his opinion on where the future of it is. And it's pretty amazing to see what he's done already and what he can do in the future. And I think, as I said earlier, in 5-10 years, this thing's going to be huge. And that's because Larry's a visionary, and he can predict what might happen in the future, it seems.
Now we're sitting here in the Sail GP base. I'm about to let you go off and start getting ready for a day of training, but I've got to ask you about this $1 million finale that's coming up in a few days' time. How do you approach something like that? Because we don't have this in sailing, but this is where Sail GP is changing the model.
It's very tough to train for these events, especially a $1 million race. It's impossible. But we don't get the boats in between events, and so we arrive a little early and get a bit of training. And fortunately, here in San Francisco, they've allowed us about 5 or 6 days of training before. So the way we prepare is we have a lot of team debriefs after the Sydney event. We were talking as a team, and then we're having a lot of sort of briefings for San Fran team meetings, and we're talking about what could happen, how it could happen, how can we prepare ourselves best for that scenario. Is there a manoeuvre in our playbook which could open up some doors for us and surprise our competitors? And then we're going through old footage and we're looking at tendencies of our competitors, mainly USA and Japan, because that's who we'll be competing against. We're trying to see if the wind is lighter, do they prefer a different starting technique? If it's heavier, do they do something? If they're in a boat-on-boat situation, are there any tendencies that could leave them vulnerable? I've watched so much footage. I've watched every event 5 times over, mainly the events we do poorly in, just to make sure I don't make the same mistakes. But that's how we prepare. It's mentally, really, and it's working as a team and making sure our dynamic's strong and making sure that there's no surprises when we hit the start line.
Understood. Now, just to finish off, we talked about your commitment to Sail GP. We talked about America's Cup. Aside from that, looking forward now, is there anything left for you that you kind of think, I need to do this at some point? I'm just thinking about, you know, the Imokas. I'm thinking about offshore racing, and maybe the Ultims might be appealing to you.
For me, I've done a bit of offshore sailing, and I still do a little bit, but it's not really for me. I struggle to get purely motivated for the offshore. I still enjoy the Sydney Hobart every now and then, and I did the Middle Sea race with Comanche last year. It's a lot of fun, but it's not me, I guess. I prefer the short course racing. But I do love super slow racing. Last weekend I was racing Far 40s in Newcastle, Australia. It's a bit of a weird preparation for the F50s in San Francisco, but I love slow boats. I love the tactical game. I'll happily jump in a laser tomorrow and go race guys. And then I'm out in my Moth every chance I get. TP52s I'll be doing plenty of this season. F50s, maybe some maxi sailing. I want to do it all and learn, because every day I go sailing I'm learning something new, and if I can do that over such a diverse area, I think every day I hit the water I'll be more comfortable in any type of scenario. So for me, not too many people know this, but I set a goals list on my way home in that train ride from the Sydney Olympics, and it started off winning a club race. Then it was winning the club championship, state titles, Australian titles, world titles, Olympic medals. But then I said there's three things I want to do in my sailing career, and it was win a gold medal, win World Sailor of the Year, and win the America's Cup. And I went through a bit of a glory period there, 2010 to 2013, where I achieved all in a couple of years. And then I sat down and said, okay, well, I've got to write new goals, and what's that going to be? And this was well before SailGP, the only thing I put down there that I would love to do is win the America's Cup with an Australian team. And I wrote that down, and it sat on my board for a long time, and then I realised that it's kind of out of my hands. In some regards, I tried to raise money. I've done that multiple times, trying to raise money and get an Australian America's Cup team going, but all unsuccessfully. And I've just kind of realised I'm not a millionaire, billionaire, and I can't help this. I can try my hardest with the skills I have, but yeah, if that came along, for sure I'd jump at the opportunity to be a part of that. But for me, what I'm doing now with SailGP and leading the Australian team against the best countries in the world, it's hard not to say a harder championship to win probably than the America's Cup now, because you've got even boats and you've got the best sailors from every country here. It's as close to the leading an Australian team in the America's Cup as you could be, so I'm very happy doing what I'm doing.
You have your future mapped out. Well, Tom, thanks for taking the time to talk to us today. It's been fascinating, as I knew it would be. And good luck at the weekend.
Yes, thank you very much. Cheers.
Well, that's it from San Francisco for this episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. My thanks to Tom Slingsby for making room in his schedule to talk to me. And thanks also to all of you around the world for listening once again. I'll be back soon with another great professional sailor interview. But for now, I'll just say, sail fast, everyone.